How did you get into the game? Were you just born into it?
I was in racing all my working life as a bookmaker's clerk and a tic tac. I started off, I was working for a man called Willie Burt. I worked at Haringey Dogs. I was at Haringey Dogs up until it closed in 1987 as a tic tac and as a clerk. I worked for a firm called Henry Alper. The actual firm was Ruby Huntman, a fella called Ruby Huntman, but Henry Alper had been his partner, and that is the name they bet in. Interestingly enough, this fella, Henry Alper, he was the owner of the old triple champion hurdle winner, Persian Wall. But as well as working at Haringey Dogs, I also worked at White City Dogs for the John White firm, who are still on course bookmakers now. And I worked at Catford Dogs for a number of years. Started off with a fella called Jimmy Robinson, early 70s, outside at Catford. We say outside, meaning the cheap ring. We say inside was the expensive ring, which was where the home straight and the winning post was. And the other side of the dog track was the cheap ring, but we used to call it outside, inside and outside. In them days, the bookmakers in the cheap rings, they used to have a tic-tac behind the joint and work off of a man who was inside. I was nearly always the man inside, showing the prices off of the bigger bookmakers in the big rings bold. At Catford, it would have been bookmakers such as Johnny Humphreys, Dave Richardson, the early days when I worked for Jimmy Robinson. The main bookmakers in the big ring at Catford was a fella called Slips Jackson, Jimmy Gent, he was a director of Crystal Palace Football Club, two brothers called Sam and Alec Cohen. They were two characters, actually, because they used to be the photo finish judges at Catford Dogs, but actually speaking, they wore glasses that were like bulletproof. They were so thick, but they were the photo finish judges. Later years, as I say, the main bookmaker at Catford was a fella called Johnny Humphreys. He owned a few horses in recent years, had quite a bit of success. He was very friendly with Terry Mills, the Epsom trainer, and he had some good horses with Terry Mills. Terry Mills used to come over to Catford Dogs as a punter, and I can remember when he started training race horses, a lot of people were a bit surprised, but he'd had dogs in the past, and he said, basically, he said, Olsen a dog, he said, there's skin and bone and muscle, and he said a lot of it is common sense, how you feed them and get them fit. And he done very well as a trainer at Epsom, Terry Mills. He was a well-known punter, though, for a number of years. He had a very good business, though, Terry Mills. He built sections of the M25. His firm was AJ Bull Aggregate and laid all the foundations on the M25. I did hear that he originally bought the stables at Epsom to park the lorries up that when he was building that section of the M25. And of course, after that all finished up, and he got the flavour of Epsom and training racehorses. One of my biggest memories like that stick in my mind working at Catford, because after Haringey shut, this is after Jimmy Robinson died, Steve Gibbs, who was a racecourse bookmaker, used to bet in the cheap ring at Catford, and he asked me if I'd go and work for him, showing the prices in the big ring. And Ray Deverson, who used to help me at Epsom and Royal Ascot on the relay, when we had a lot of firms in the silver ring, and obviously at Epsom, apart from the silver ring, all the outside, I mean, we had firms at Epsom, used to be up as far as Tattenham Corner working off of us. Ray got the job behind the joint for Steve Gibbs, and we were a good team for a number of years there at Catford. What stuck in my mind about Catford, though, was a particular summer's evening. I'd come back from the races. The bookmakers were just about chalking up the prices for the first race. Dogs had come out the kennels parading. I was putting my white gloves on, and all of a sudden there was a most almighty bang up the top end by the first bend where the turnstiles and main gate were. And when we looked up there, what had happened? A minicab dropping some people at the main entrance. It turned out, instead of braking, he hit the accelerator. The car smashed through the main gate, and it actually killed a man and woman who'd just gone through the turnstile and were coming into the dog track. Very sad night that was. Obviously, the meeting was cancelled, and very, very tragic, really. They were two regular Catford race goers. The funniest thing I can remember, that happened at Aringay Dogs when I was working there. It was a very foggy night. It was touch and go whether the meeting would go ahead. Anyway, they ran two or three races, and all of a sudden dogs were in the traps, and the hairdriver was giving the dogs a short hair to give them sight light of the hair because of the fog. Anyway, traps opened up, the dogs hurtled down the home straight, round the first bend, and all us, like, in the big ring, we're looking for the dogs to come off the fourth bend and run home down to the winning line, when all of a sudden they come off the first bend going the wrong way round again. They must have lost sight of the hare over the back straight, turned round and ran back the wrong way. I think the meeting was cancelled after that night. After that, though, I can remember a night again in the fog at Haringey. They used to get a lot of fog in the winter meetings at Haringey. They put a torch on the end of the hare to help the dogs follow it round. But yeah, Haringey had a hell of a lot of bookmakers on the outside as well as in the big ring when I first started working there, early 70s, 1970. I reckon there was about 20, 22 books outside then. I can remember a lot of them as it happens, like, you know, you can remember all the firms. There was Dave Langham, Tony Esther, a fella called Bill Baker, a fella betting the name of Longboat, Wagshaw, Peter Buffoni, Billy Grimes bet out there, a fella called George Braham. As I say, there was no end of books outside of Haringey, and that's where my grandfather bet, but he turned it up. When I was quite a young boy, really, my grandfather turned it up. They brought in a tax, I think it was sixpence in the pound or something, and he just pulled the tools down one night, and that was the end of it. He didn't want to pay the sixpence in the pound. He turned it up then. I think he bet on the first bend there. A lot of people from around the area he lived bet on the first bend at Haringey. He knew most of them. And obviously when I started working, there was no bookmakers on the bends. They were just like on the home straight or the back straight, you know. But Haringey was never like going to work, actually. It was a laugh a minute there, always joking. And very sad that that shut in 1987, because it was a successful track. They used to get a lot of people there. They used to run in the finish Monday, Wednesday and Friday. Always used to be Monday and Friday, but then they put a Wednesday meeting in as well. That wasn't quite as popular as Monday and Friday. When I first started working at the Dogs, it was eight races, 7:45 to 9:45. So it went very quick, really. I mean, I think the punters liked it as well, because the men used to go to the Dogs, and last race, 9:45, they could get back to the local. Perhaps the missus was in the local Friday night, buy her a couple of drinks, keep her sweet, and you know, I think it was detrimental when they started going to 10 and then 12 races because, you know, it was too long and drawn out. I always used to think the Panthers used to come in the track with the same amount of money in their pocket to play up, whether there was 8 races, 12 races. I know when I finished up at Walthamstow, there was 14 races there on a Saturday night. It's just too much. The type of dogs that were running as well. But when there was 8 races, everyone knew the dogs like the back of their hand. They knew their style of running, what led, what finished well. But then when they started putting all these extra races on, you got a lot of trialists, newcomers, dogs coming back from lameness, all that type of thing. And the form was not so reliable as it used to be with 8 races. Walthamstow was a tragedy, yeah, that shut. That was the most recent one that shut. That shut about 9 years ago, I suppose, now, and it was still a thriving dog track. I mean, Lowell Black, who printed my Tic Tac card up, the Palsy Printing Works, he used to print the race card for Walthamstow dogs. And the Chandler family never used to like to have one race car printed that wasn't sold. So you can bet your life, like, there was always at least 1,000 there on a Tuesday night, 1,500 on a Thursday, and up to 3,000 people on a Saturday night at Walthamstow Stadium. A lot of times, all the race cards were sold out half hour before the first race, so even at the end, it was a thriving dog track. And with Walthamstow, I mean, the doors used to open at 6 p.m. The restaurant, the Paddock Grill, was booked up 2-3 months in advance. And after the dogs, they used to have a club there called Charlie Chan's that went on till 2 o'clock in the morning. So the Chandlers had a captured audience at Walthamstow Dogs from 6 p.m. till 2 a.m. in the morning. Very, very sad that Walthamstow Dogs shut. The early days of going racing, we used to travel on the train a lot them days because obviously the fares were a lot cheaper than they are now. And also, the bookmakers' tools, you could fold a tripod up, carry an odd in your hand. It was a lot easier than nowadays. I mean, nowadays they're so heavy and cumbersome, these tools, that you need a car to put all this stuff in the boot of a car. That's why hardly anyone ever travels on the train now. But in them days, you could get on a train with a set of bookmaker's tools. We used to get the train most places from London because we had so many stations in London that served all the race courses. Wherever you wanted to go, you could get the train there. Brighton was a particular good train service because on the hour was the fast train from Victoria, London, to Brighton. And we used to get the early train because you used to get there down at Brighton, jump in a cab. We used to go to the bottom of the hill, like where the race course was. There was a pub there called the Freshfield Inn. Very good landlady ran it, a woman called Mrs. Rachel Epstein. And she always had food there. You could buy a bowl of jelly deals and used to have saucer of cockles, saucer of prawns and different things she had laid on. And all the racing people used to get in this pub before the meetings, especially a lot of the workmen, which it was very handy because if you were going on to the dogs that night, it gave you like a chance to have a couple of pints of beer and a couple of sandwiches or something to eat, keep you going throughout the day. Another woman had a pub opposite the grandstand at Brighton. Pub was called the Winning Post, a woman called Alice Maney. She came from London originally. Well, her son, Harry Maney, worked as a tic tac and clerk for years. I knew Harry working for various people. He worked for the John White firm. He worked for Dave Sapphire. He was a good all-round workman, a good clerk and a workman. But his mum had the pub opposite the racecourse. We used to get on the train at Victoria to go down to Brighton, and everyone used to make for the Buffy car. The reason being, there was tables in that car, and they wasn't used for eating meals or anything. They was used for the card games. They used to play Kaluki in them days, and there could be up to 7 or 8 Kaluki games going on in the Buffy car going down to Brighton. I always used to think a fella used to win more times than not was a fella called Arthur Droy. He worked for the same tic-tac firm as me, for Johnny Mac. And he had a nickname, actually. We used to call him Savaloy, Droy. You see, in them days, a lot of people had nicknames, either through rhyming slang or whatever, you know. There was a fella had a red face and blonde hair. He used to be called Rhubarb and Custard. And there was another guy. He always seemed to be having affairs with married women, this fella. And he got the nickname Housewife's Choice. Because at the time, it was a popular radio show. Used to play requests, record requests. It was called Housewife's Choice. But this fella got the nickname for another reason. On the way home from Brighton, again, the train was always packed going back to London. Used to play cards on it again, and a lot of people used to have a drink. The Buffy car used to sell miniature spirits, cans of beer and everything. And of course, if the bookies had had a good day and topped the workmen up with honours, there was a few songs being sung and jokes being told. Everyone was in a good mood. When I worked for Johnny Mac at Brighton, this was many years ago, there was bookmakers beyond the Silver Ring. I mean, the Silver Ring, there was a good few bookmakers in. It was a busy, buzzy Silver Ring. Even when I took over my own tic-tac firm, which I ran for about 17 years, I had plenty of customers in the Silver Ring at Brighton. But when I worked for John, there was bookmakers on the free course going up the straight at Brighton. And they used to bet on big point-to-point joints out there. John used to have a tic-tac in the Silver Ring stand, high up in the Silver Ring stand. A fella called Shuffer Allen was a very good tic-tac. And he had the Silver Ring firms and the firms up the straight. Johnny Mac was on the top of the grandstand, like the Tattersall stand. He had firms opposite the grandstand. There's no bookmakers there now, but there used to be firms bet out there. One particular fella used to work off of us, Mikey Connors, betting the name of Jack Piper. But there was a fair few firms over that other side, opposite Tattersall's. And then there was all the Tattersall's firms. I used to be on a box on the rails. And like, if a firm betting outside on the free course, 3 furlongs from home, wanted a bet, they used to go through the man on the Silver Ring steps. He used to relay the bet to Johnny Mac, and he used to throw it down to me on the rails. I'd have the bet with the rails bookmaker, and then it was returned through John to Shuffer Allen, and then out to the bookmaker outside. Worth having 4 workmen in them days, because you had so many customers. Originally, we used to charge £2 for the tic-tac card and £5 if you worked. And if you worked, you could do 1 bet or 31 bets through the day. So they got good value out of the tic-tac firms, the bookmakers. There was 4 tic-tac firms when I was working. The Johnny Mac firm, which was a blue card. It was white at one time, but then he had a blue coloured card printed up. Mickey Oakey firm, who I also worked for a few years, he had a yellow card. Mickey Fingers, who Billy Brown took the firm over when Mickey collapsed at Royal Ascot, about 1980 that was, they was a white card. And when I had my own business, I was a red card. And the reason we all had different coloured cards, because some firms who'd done a lot of trading took the four cards off of all the four Tic Tac firms. Because sometimes, like, a horse might be 11 to 10 with three of the firms, and another firm would put it in at evens, and all of a sudden, like, a silver ring firm could send up to lay a £22 to 20 or 55 to 50 with the firm that put it in at evens, although the other firms were still showing 11 to 10. And it was easier for the Tic Tac working for the bookie behind the joint to see, like, the colour of the various cards, who was showing the evens rather than the 11 to 10. Because if it was a 10-run race, all the four different Tic Tac firms with different cards twisted the numbers. They were twisted from the race card. The top weight also on the race card was number one. Now, on Mickey Oakey's card, it might be number five. On my card, it might be number seven. On Johnny Mac's card, it might be number nine. Billy Brown's card, it might be number two. So you had to have the various Tic Tac cards to know what price the horse they were showing. Because how it worked was, when a firm wanted to have a bet with various firms, every firm had a different sign for the various Tic Tacs. Say, for instance, the firm outside Bobby Mac's firm. He was a silver ring bookmaker, Bobby, Johnny Mac's younger brother. If he wanted to call up, say, the Mickey Oakey firm, his sign, his call sign with Mickey Oakey might have been one arm out. His call sign with his brother Johnny was 9-2. His call sign with me might have been 33. And his call sign with Billy Brown might have been two arms out. So if he wanted a bet with, like, the firm who his sign was 33, he'd call them up. That firm had fastened onto his calling them. So right away, the contract for having a bet was opened between the Tic Tac and the bookmaker. Now, the Tic Tac behind the bookmaker's joint, once he's opened the contract up to have a bet, he would send the bet up. Say the horse was the three horse, and he wanted 40 quid on at 9-2. That would go up to the Tic Tac at the top of the stand. He'd relay it down to his Tic Tac on the rail, who would have it with one of the rail bookmakers. He'd return it to the Tic Tac at the top of the stand. And the Tic Tac at the top of the stand, he gives the man his call sign, which 33 sign, like that, and return the bet to him. The three horse, 40 at 9-2, and then shut the contract with the sign. And that's how it worked. That's how the Tic Tac worked. Another race course that was always a magical place to work, really, was Epsom, especially the Derby meeting, if you was a Tic Tac, because there were so many bookmakers scattered all over the Downs, up the straight. There was a silver ring there at the time, Tattersalls, there was a lot of rails bookmakers. And at Epsom, the Tic Tacs built a scaffold. And that scaffold was going on the hill opposite the Tattersalls stand, going up near the number bold. And the Tic Tac used to be on the top of the scaffold, and he could have sight all across the Downs and pick up the various firms that were calling him up that worked various sections on the firm, on the Downs. There was a firms up at Tattenham Colne used to work off you. Firms in what we used to call Shyster's Alley. It's called the Walton Enclosure now, got a rather posher name. Opposite the grandstand was where the buses used to park up. That's now called the Lonsdale Enclosure, That was never an enclosure. That was always part of the free coastline, the hill, where there was a lot of bookmakers. Then there was Langlands, and there was a lot of bookmakers. Grandstand side of the race course past the Silver Ring. When I worked for Johnny Mack, we had a man on the top of the Silver Ring stand. Johnny Mack used to be on the steps in Tattersalls underneath the big clock. There was a big clock on the stand at Tattersalls, and the tic-tacs were all plotted up underneath that clock. And man on the rail, and you also had tic-tac in between the Tattersalls pitches, mingling between the crowd and the bookmakers, because say a firm up Tattenham Corner, they might have been laying 14 to one odds, might have been ridden by a fashionable jockey, or might have been a name that caught the public's imagination. They might have been laying 12 or 14. The tic-tacs were showing that they could have 20 hit. Well, on the relay, they'd have, say, a 20 tenners back. The rails bookmakers in them days never had bolts, so they wasn't too interested in laying rags, the rails bookmakers. So the tic-tac at the top of the stand would call his man up down in the Tattersalls ring, mingling between the ring bookmakers, and they might have been able to get 33 or maybe bigger this horse that the man wanted, the 20 tenners, and that they'd have a 200 to 6, something like that, the horse. So it was worth employing another man to work on the floor. There was one particular tic-tac that worked up at Tattenham Corner. It was a long look, Tattenham Corner, up to the man on the end of the Silver Ring stand. Some of them used to use binoculars, but this one fella, Winkle, he only had one eye, and yet that one eye, he could see better than people with two eyes. It was amazing. That always used to amaze me, old Winkle, how he worked that distance from Tattenham Corner up to Chaffer Allen in the Silver Ring. There was bookmakers all over the course, though, at Epsom, and it was a very, very busy meeting, and a hell of a lot of business was done. The hardest part of Epsom Derby Day was to collate all the figures and get the accounts to balance, because you had to get them balanced up that night. So as you walked on, in them days the Derby was on a Wednesday, because they used to race on the fresh ground, like, you know. As you walked it on the Thursday, all the bookmakers would be queuing up to settle up with you, and you had to know the figures for 50 or 60 bookmakers, if you included all the bookmakers that were betting on the hill in Shyster's Alley, opposite the grandstand where the buses parked up, beyond the Silver Ring on the free course, in the Silver Ring, Tattersalls and Rails bookmakers. But that was the hardest part of the tic-tac game, getting four tic-tacs cards together and collating all the bets from the various firms that they had working off of them. The man in the Silver Ring might have had 20 customers. The man working on the rail might have had another 15 or so in Tattersalls. The man upstairs under the clock, he might have had four or five firms out on the hill, and the bookies that bet in front of the buses. We had to get all that to balance, and then we used to do it race by race and then do the daily figure. Some bookmakers had a weekly account. We used to call the figure over and agree it, carry it forward. But most firms were settled day by day, and it'd be a huge job, like getting a balance a day like Derby Day. And we was often up burning the midnight oil till we did get a balance. There were very, very few mistakes made tic-tacking, because the system was so good. Like, every firm had a call sign with the various tic-tac firms, and the odd occasion it may have happened, and it was the very, very odd occasion. Very few tic-tacs were ever in the rooms. I know all the years that I worked tic-tacking, for Johnny Mac, Mickey Oakey, and my own firm. I was never ever in the rooms, or we went to arbitration. You might have got a tic tac fasten on the wrong bet once a year or something like that, and you come to an amicable arrangement and half the bet. But the mistakes were so few and far between, it was unbelievable. And this was the fascination of it all. I mean, you used to get race goers that they'd just stand looking at you, even not having a bet. They were just so fascinated by the Tic Tacs. Their white gloves, I mean, we was all smart fellas, suits and ties, and the public used to love it. That's why when the Tic Tac died, the race course definitely lost a lot of colour. I think Epsom's lost a lot of its colour and atmosphere. Epsom going to the Derby on a Saturday, but they say it's progress, I don't know. Talking about Epsom, I didn't know it was him at the time, but the first time I ever met JP McManus, I was on Victoria Station about 8:30. I always used to get to Epsom early, Derby Day. And an Irish fella about my age came up to me. He said, I know you go to the races. He said, and he looked up at the board where the times of the trains were. He looked up, he said to me, Tattenham Corner, another train Epsom Town, and another train going to Epsom Downs. What's the best train for me to get on? So I said to him, Epsom Town. I said, 50-1 on. He said, oh, right. I said, Tattenham Corner train stops every station through South London, and it's a long walk from Tattenham Corner to the grandstand or the members' enclosure, wherever you're going. I said, Epsom Downs, you're in the middle of nowhere. It's a long walk to the racecourse. But I said, if you get a train to Epsom Town, it's a lot faster train. And also, there's no end of taxis, or you can hop on a bus up to the racecourse up the hill. So I said, Epsom Town. A few years after that, I was reading the paper one day, and the photo was in there of this Irish bookmaker, JP McManus, who was laying very big bets in Ireland and owned race horses, coming to Cheltenham, backing his horses. And I thought back to that day on Victoria Station, it was JP McManus that asked me what train to get on to go to the Derby. He's always said hello to me whenever he's seen me at the races ever since. Another race course, we didn't used to go there very often on the train because it was so difficult to get to on the train, was Newmarket. Train used to go from Liverpool Street Station to Cambridge, and it was a long ride in a taxi from Cambridge to Newmarket. So what the bookmakers' workmen done, they used to get a coach. An old Tic Tac called Tiger used to run the coach. It was Solly Dreyer's coach. He was the coach firm, Solly Dreyer. He used to start at the Borough Market. That was the first pickup in South London over the Water. Then he used to go to Liverpool Street, the bottom of Petticoat Lane, outside Dirty Dick's pub, pick up another lot of workmen there. And the last stop was the Kenninghall roundabout near Clapton Docks. Another lot of workmen got on. Then the coach used to go up to Newmarket Racecourse, and there was always a lot of tall stories and lies and people getting divorced from reality, shall we say, rather than telling lies on that coach. And again, if the bookies had a good day at Newmarket and topped the workmen up with honours, there was always a lot of songs being sung and jokes being told on the way home. One or two punters as well used to get on that coach to Newmarket back to London, and you know, a lot of funny stories there. I can remember two race course spivs, they were. They used to be like race course tipsters. A fella called Jimmy the One He was always very, very smartly dressed, and a little Scotchman called Hughie, who by the end of the day was always quite drunk. Now, Hughie and Jimmy the One had an altercation on the coach going home one night. Anyway, Jimmy the One stood up, Hughie stood up, and he got Jimmy the One round the neck, he said, by the tie. And the fashion in them days was them big kipper ties with the big Windsor knots. And he was choking Jimmy the One with the Windsor knot. It just seemed funny at the time, like, you know. And then everyone would get him to sit down, it had all calmed down. Then about 20 minutes after, Hughie would be off again, and that went on all the way back to Newmarket, to London, like, back to Liverpool Street. One night, very sad, like, coming home from Newmarket, where we used to get off the coach, some of us used to have a drink after racing, and this particular night, it was the Wednesday of the July course meeting. Tiger, who ran the coach, he organised it, and like, you had to pay Tiger the fare. He was like the booker in. We went on to a pub in Oxton Street, Oxton Market, Henry Brown's pub. It was a popular pub at the time. Even on a Wednesday night, it was lively. There were singers in there. We'd have two or three drinks, come out, so there's racing the next day. Tiger stayed in there right till the end, last orders. Anyway, he got a cab home, a taxi cab home. He didn't live far from there, to New North Road. And instead of getting out the cab, where I suppose he'd had a few drinks, getting out the cab on the pavement side, he got out the cab the roadside. And there was a big meat lorry coming down New North Road going to Smithfield Meat Market, and it ran Tiger right over, killed him outright, and that was very, very sad. Connie Driscoll took the coach over after that. Connie was one of a family of Tic Tacs. There was Jerry Driscoll, Connie Driscoll, Patsy, Johnny, Teddy. I think there was about six brothers. Danny Driscoll was another one. Jerry, Connie and Teddy were the main ones that tic-tacked, but they tic-tacked all their life. As I say, after Tiger died, Connie took over the responsibility of running the Newmarket coach. Talking about having a drink before and after racing, I'm just thinking that pub in Brighton that we used to go before the racing, all the racing fellas used to get in there for a half hour before, like, going up to the race course. A Birmingham bookie who bet in the silver ring, George Moore, he used to love a pint of bitter. I think he had like a couple more than he normally did this particular day. The first race he's betting on up at Brighton. Anyway, he had a good race on it, and it was a selling race. So, for some reason, George Moore fancied buying the winner of the seller. And he went round to where they was auctioning the winner, and he bought the winner. He bought it. And as it happens, the horse turned out fairly decent. It won three or four races afterwards, and I think it was George had a bit of Dutch courage from the beer in the Freshfield Inn. But anyway, George wound up, apart from going back to Birmingham with a few quid in winnings, he went back with the owner of a racehorse as well. Yarmouth was another seaside racecourse that we used to go to on the train sometimes. The train used to go from Liverpool Street to Norwich, but used to have to change at Norwich to a little local line. And it was a slow train. It stopped at all little country stations till you got to Vauxhall Yarmouth station. And I can remember once or twice we were stranded in Norwich. The local train was cancelled, and it was a long way in a cab from Norwich to Yarmouth, but like all the racing fellas, you used to make sure they got there, whatever happened. Fella used to take the lists up there and the tic-tac cards from the fella, Lowell Black, who printed our cards up. I mentioned him before. He printed the race cards for Walthamstow Dogs. Lowell Black was the son of Charles Black, or Deffy as we know him, and he started the business up, I believe, in the 20s with a fella called Edward Emanuel. Anyway, when I was tic-tacking and the son, Lowell Black, used to print my tic-tac cards up, as well as the lists that the bookmakers used to put on the joint and price up, chalk up the prices of the horses, the list of runners. Well, a fella called Darbo Hicks, used to take the lists and the tic-tac cards to the races. He always used to be on the train to Yarmouth, and he had the most amazing stories to tell and jokes to tell. His son was Tommy Steele, the entertainer, and he always used to have newspaper cuttings and pictures of where Tommy Steele was appearing or what film he was going to be in, because he made three or four hit records, number one hit records, Tommy Steele. But Darbo himself was a great character. One night when we were staying up at Yarmouth, he got in a pub in Yarmouth that had a piano, and he could sing a song and knock out a tune on the old piano. There's good times up at Yarmouth them days. Yarmouth was another place, always seemed to do good ice cream. It was like Salisbury. I can remember when I worked for the John White firm there at Yarmouth, young John White used to love the ice cream up at Yarmouth. But we used to go in the firm's car at the time, old John White. This John White was better now, his father was alive, and he had a Rolls Royce. Personalised number plate, JW353, and it used to be fantastic going to the races, sitting in the back of a Rolls Royce. We used to leave early sometimes when we went in the car to Yarmouth, and used to go down onto the quayside, and there was a fella used to go to Yarmouth races called Tomo. He was the original Tomo, not the Tomo who's the commentator. He knew one or two of the fellas that worked on the docks at Yarmouth, and we used to go there and buy a box of kippers or box of bloaters from the docks, like fresh, and take them home to London, like from the Yarmouth docks. Another place used to be a race train, just a race train. It was only for the races. It was Newbury. We used to get race special from Paddington to Newbury Racecourse. There was a platform there at the racecourse. The train usually only ever stopped Newbury Town, but on race days it stopped at Newbury Racecourse. Now and again we used to get stranded at Reading if something happened with a train or that, but you could always get a cab from Reading to Newbury. It'd be amazing for some of the old timers to come back that used to make a book at Newbury to see the building work that's gone on there. I mean, they've built blocks of flats all along the straight, and two blocks of flats at the bottom of the home straight where the stable blocks used to be, and a lot of like three-storey Georgian style houses. I must say though, it's a very tasteful development. They've done it to a high standard, and it blends in very well. Thinking about it, Newbury would probably be shut now if it wasn't for all this development. So in a way, it's all worked out for the best. To think where the old Silver Ring was, it is a block of flats now, seems quite unbelievable. Used to be the Geoffrey Freer stand out there. Then there was the Silver Ring. Then there was Tats. We used to have several firms out beyond the Silver Ring. There was a firm bet out there, Dave Bindon. And interestingly enough, his son Luke Bindon, who works for William Hill on the rail now, has bought one of the flats that actually are where the Silver Ring used to be. And I often think that I saw Luke looking over the balcony, and I thought, Where I'm standing now is probably where your dad bet in the old Geoffrey Freer stand years ago. But as I say, like, probably it's all turned out for the best at Newbury, because who knows, the race course was struggling a little bit, and I think, you know, if it wasn't for all this development, it might have been shut down. The grandfather who used to bet at Aringay Dogs, he turned it up when they introduced a sixpence in the pound tax there. He only used to bet at the races one day a year. He used to go to Epsom on Derby Day. He only used to bet one day at the races. Other than that, he was always like at Aringay Dogs. And after he turned up making a book, he was always a punter. The dog's quite well known, actually. The London Dog Tracks, but there was a lot of very good judges, London Dogs, years ago. A lot of people used to go to the trials with their stopwatches, and they used to time the dogs. I remember clerking at Hackney Dogs one Thursday afternoon for John Power. He was a big bookmaker at the time, John. And he had a scrap metal dealer called Charlie Fergus betting with him. Charlie Fergus used to have tugboats that pulled the rigs in off of the North Sea when they'd all corroded and deteriorated and got dangerous. He used to pull them into Felixstowe and cut them up. Anyway, Charlie Fergus used to bet with John, and I can remember John saying to me one day he'd rather lay Charlie Fergus an 11,000 to 10 and even money chance than a fella who was a very good judge at Hackney, a man called One Arm Lou. Very, very good judge at Hackney, well-known man, used to go to all the trials. He said, I'd rather lay Charlie Fergus 11,000 to 10 than One Arm Lou an £11 to 10. So I laughed, so he said, I'm serious. He said, One Arm Lou is a consistent winner here and wins plenty off me over the year, even with his small money, whereas Charlie Fergus is a big loser over the year. So he said, I wouldn't mind laying him a little bit bigger just to keep him sweet. The Power Firm, in later years, they bet at Wembley, they also bet at Haringey. They sponsored a number of races at all these tracks, but the track that they were really well known at was Walthamstow. They'd done a hell of a lot of sponsorship at Walthamstow. They bet there for years and years. Their father bet there, as he had at Hackney, and their uncle, Bert Lamb, bet on the joint as well. The later years of White City Dogs, the Powers come in there, had a pitch there, and so did Tony Morris towards the latter years of White City Dogs. There was massive punters at White City Dogs, so it was a few fellas sat on a table in the restaurant. It was always known as Ebby's Table. They was always big punters. Michael Tabor backed dogs there regularly. He was regular at White City. He used to back dogs with Johnny White as well as various other bookmakers. Tony Morris, they used to say he had a punter, an Arab. He didn't used to like coming down and having a bet, like calling a bet, but he sent his man down, his chauffeur, to give Tony Morris an envelope, and Tony Morris couldn't open the envelope up till after the race. And in the envelope used to be a £1,000 bet, trap two, trap five. Tony Morris didn't know till after the race was run. It could have been an even money chance or a 10-1 chance. I mean, it was like shoot out at the OK Corral, really. But Tony Morris, he went on to bet at Wimbledon after White City Shut. Used to make a very big book on the Ground Derby. White City had some very big bookmakers, though, in the big ring, fella called Phil Earle, man with one leg. He used to be a very good bridge player. He used to stand dogs for a lot of money, as did Tom Stanley. He was another big bookmaker. When I was working there for John White, the the bookmakers up by the winning post were Joe Norris on the end, two brothers, Teddy and Jacko Craze, Johnny White, Tom Stanley and Phil Earl. Up the other end, towards the end, was a firm called Pat Whitmarsh. He was a fiddler. Wolfrey was another fiddler. Then Tony Morris and the Powers were there. And on the end of that line was Ronnie Howes. He used to make a book at Aringay as well, Ronnie Howes. And then there was a number of bookmakers outside at White City as well. Saturday nights, Stan Bowles used to come back there, used to play for QPR at the time. He used to come back there backing dogs with his friend Don Shanks. Don Shanks went out with the Miss World. She was regular at White City, Mary Stavins, and there was a little gang of them, Minnie Cooper and Henry. I mean, I can remember being outside at White City before racing, half hour before the first race, the jelly deal stole, and Mary Stavins walked by, the Miss World at the time. She was waiting for Don Shanks to come back, the footballer. I bashed into Mary Stavins, funny enough, many years later at Lingfield Park Races, and she told me she'd married an American banker and was living in a village not far from Lingfield at Dorman's Land. But they were funny days though at White City, all the characters and punters there. It was a huge track, White City, like stadium. Semi-finals of the 1966 World Cup was held there. And dog derby nights, I mean, the roar of the crowd was unbelievable. Even when I was there, you could get 30, 40,000 people there watching the ground derby. Don't think you'll ever get them days back again. The terraces were absolutely full to capacity and punters were fighting to get on. They used to double up the bookmakers, like every bookmaker could have a second pitch in different areas of the dog track to accommodate the amount of punters that were there on the dog derby night. Years ago, the bookmakers probably bet to better figures than they do now. Reason being now that bookmakers have to be very competitive because not only you've got the betting exchanges that bet to a 0% market, you've got the big firms giving offers away second to the favourite, or you're horse beating the neck or less, money back, best odds guaranteed. Bookmakers have to be a lot more competitive now. Years ago though, there were some very good bookmakers used to bet at the races down the south of England. I mean, Fred Binns was a notable bookmaker that used to bet in running. He was a tremendous judge in running. As the horses used to jump off, especially over the jumps, but he used to bet him running on the flat as well. He used to stand on a high box with his binoculars up, and that's how he got the name Binns. His real name was Sturman, Ted Sturman. And he used to offer prices in running. Can always remember one day, Fred Binns, he was at Sandown Park, and a horse going to the last, Fred Binns asked for 10 to 1. He shouted out, "I'll take 10 under the 1. So it was a racecourse regular there who never had much money, to tell you the truth. He was a good try though. He shouted out to Ted, 10.50's on. And Binns looked round and he looked at him, and I don't think Ted fancied getting the monkey off him if the horse went on the floor at the last. So Ted said, no, nothing, not you. So the fella said, 10 ponies on. So Binns said, no, nothing. In the end, the fella said, let me bet a 10 fivers on. I haven't got a shilling in the world, Ted. But nowadays, you know, with this betting in running, where Ted Binns probably asked for 10-1 and was happy to have it bet on to balance the book up, because he always bet to his book as well as his opinion in running, it would probably be betting 50-1 on nowadays. So, I mean, I hear stories about they bet 100-1 on now in running and happy to do so. They're braver than me, but they're clever, them boys who bet in running. Other bookmakers that used to make a book was a great character, Jackie Cohen. I worked for him 1 year at Cheltenham, the big meeting. He had a pitch. It was the first year that they opened the Guinness Village up. Would have been the early 80s, I think. So it was the year that Dickinson had the first five in the Gold Cup. They opened the Guinness Village up, and a few bookmakers from Tattersalls took up pitches the other side of the members' enclosure where the Guinness Village was. And on seniority, Jack Cohen had the top pitch. Now, Cohen always used to like to trade, but you couldn't see from the pitch he was betting in up across the members' enclosure to the row. So what he'd done, he got me and Johnny Mack to work for him. He had John behind the joint in the Guinness Village. I was on a big high box in the silver ring, the other side of the course, and we had a man, Chrissy Brown, on the rows. So when Jackie Cohen wanted a back a horseback, John used to send the bet over to me in the silver ring, and I used to relay the bet back across the race course to Chris Brown on the row. And Jack Cohen had a marvellous edge that year on the other bookmakers, because where he had a three-man relay, he was trading freely with the rows, whereas the other bookmakers, because they couldn't see the row across the members' enclosure, which you know the hill at Cheltenham, what with the slant, you just couldn't see for the amount of people. He was a good character though, Jackie Cohen, great character, and a very good bookmaker. He lived down in Brighton. He was a Brighton man. He moved down to Brighton from London, I think, many years ago. There's a lot of good bookmakers in the silver ring as well, though. I mean, people like Bobby Mack made a good living in the silver ring, and he taught me all I know about the game, actually, more than anybody else. Although I had a grandfather, a bookmaker, and my dad went racing, and Bobby Mack really was my mentor. I mean, I knew how to tic-tac and everything, but as far as making a book and really understanding figures and also studying the form, he was a very, very fine form book judge, Bobby Mack. He was a fella for years and years done the tissue, the prices of the race horses, called Jack the Judge. And the bookmakers used to pay Jack the Judge a fiver for his prices. And he was very, very good, Jack the Judge, very knowledgeable, put a lot of work in. But Bob used to always be the first bookmaker that priced up. And he used to get Jack's card, marry it in with his own prices, and he used to be the first one up. And considering like there was no Betfair in them days for guidance or anything like that, Bobby made very, very few mistakes. Very few mistakes.
Okay, Rocky, it's a very colourful colourful career you've given us there. Right, so here we are. You're still a bookmaker in your own right, betting as Carol Ross on the rails, several race courses. Obviously, it's a lot different these days. How do you feel about racing and bookmaking at the moment?
Well, I've been a bookmaker in my own right for 14 years now, because the Tic Tac finished up with the buying and selling of pitches when the NJPC came in. All the new bookmakers that bought the pitches, near enough to a man, never took a Tic Tac card. They didn't really understand it or how it worked. And most of our old customers were all the ones that sold. I was never so shocked as the money they got for the pitches. I mean, I think it shocked a lot of us that have been in the game for a long time, that the money that changed hands for a lot of these pitches. I mean, I think some of the new people that bought into the game were under an illusion about how good the game was. I mean, you know, the good pitches are still good, the rails pitches. I was fortunate. I had the foresight to buy rails pitches, And I also had the advantage of I was working on course every day, tic-tacking. The last 2 or 3 years I tic-tacked, I could notice certain brace courses deteriorated. For some reason, Sandown, the in and out money that the tic-tacs handled, it just collapsed really. And yet Sandown Park's 20 minutes on the train to Waterloo into central London. It is basically southwest London. It's a beautiful situated race course. Even if you stand on the ground, not even up on the steps of the stand, it's a perfect panoramic view. It's like an amphitheatre. You see all the racing, all the action, yet it just seemed to die a death to me, and I never ever bought a pitch there. Newmarket Rowley Mar was another place I never wanted to buy a pitch. Reason being, the last few years I tic-tacked, they built a new stand there on the Rowley Mall, and I don't know the reason for it, but as soon as that new stand was built, the place collapsed as far as business went for bookmakers. I used to have a lot of firms out in the Silver Ring, a lot of Tattersall's firms. There was big money change hands on the Rowley Mall. It was a real big gambling course. Not only 2,000 guineas day, 1,000 guineas day, the big Alton meetings, the Cambridgeshire meeting, the Cesarewitch meeting, that was always big gambling meetings, but even a couple of other meetings there, like the Craven. There was always unrace maidens and unrace two-year-olds that people in Newmarket had a buzz about, and there was plenty of money changing hands. Yes, it was a bit of a flap, them unraced horses, them races, but it made for a lot of business and a lot of action. But as soon as they built that new stand, as I say, the business collapsed. I think nowadays most of the main business is conducted with a members enclosure, and I was very fortunate that I had the foresight. I could see Tattersall's was going the same as the Silver Rings had 20 years before. Because when I came into the game, the Silver Rings were very, very busy. I mean, as I say, we all had 3-4 man relay teams because there were so many teams on the outside and in the Silver Rings. So many bookmakers wanted to trade with Tic Tacs out there. The last few years our Tic Tac, the Silver Rings died a death. I mean, Bobby Mack used to bet outside at Sandown, opposite the grandstand. And I know on Whitbread Gold Cup Day, I used to have 10, 12 firms working out there. I used to sell 15, 16 cards and 10 or 12 of them work. That's a car park now. There's not even a bookmaker out there. So when I decided to buy a few pitches, because when the Tic Tac finished up, I was basically unemployable, I bought Rouse pitches. And it's been the best thing I ever done because they've appreciated in price so much. Also, in the last couple of years, I've tried to buy at one or two places a second pitch because I never thought that would work, but it definitely does. Two pitches are better than one. I used to think the expenses of working two pitches didn't warrant having two pitches, but they certainly do. And I wish I'd have had the hindsight to have gone the way of two pitches a lot earlier, because the pitches now are at a premium on the rails and they're very expensive. Anyway, I've had a marvellous life in racing, as I say, as a working Tic Tac, running my own Tic Tac firm. I've worked for marvellous people, marvellous bookmakers, both at the dogs and the races. I hope I'm wrong, but it probably won't be in my lifetime, but I think in the future, I worry that race courses might go the same way as the London dog tracks, that the real estate, the land is so valuable that it's better off for the owners to sell the race courses for development, as the Greyhound Racing Association and the owners of the dog tracks did in London. I mean, already Kempton, the jockey club, are saying they'd like to sell it and they're requesting planning permission. I think it's a sad way to go. And I think if it happens with Kempton, it can happen with other race courses as well. Anyway, on that rather black note, I'll say goodbye to everybody.
Star Sports TV, our weekly magazine TV programme packed with tips, news and banter on the key sports events of the week. Check out the latest episode at starsportsbet.co.uk. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.